Welcome, and thank you everyone for participating in today's webinar, Advocating for LGBT Long-Term Care Consumers, Resources for Long-Term Care Ombudsmen, hosted by the National Long-Term Care Ombudsman Resource Center. I'm Jessica Brill-Ortiz, the Program Manager at the Consumer Voice, where the Resource Center is housed, and I'm happy to be facilitating this event. Today's webinar seeks to address the challenges faced by LGBT, which stands for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, long-term care consumers, and current work and initiatives to support LGBT consumers and advocacy on their behalf by ombudsmen and other advocates. We hope the webinar will raise ombudsman awareness of the challenges facing LGBT consumers in long-term care facilities, identify existing resources and support for LGBT long-term care consumers, and highlight the role of ombudsmen advocating on behalf of and with LGBT consumers and why this is such important work. I am pleased to introduce the four speakers on today's webinar. First, we'll hear from Hillary Meyer, Director of the National Resource Center on LGBT Aging. We are also pleased to be joined by Sue, who lives in an independent living section of a continuing care retirement community in Colorado. Next, we'll hear from Eric Carlson, directing attorney at the National Senior Citizens Law Center, followed by Jennifer Solms, an ombudsman with the Denver Regional Council of Governments in Colorado. In terms of webinar logistics, the event is being recorded and all lines are muted. We encourage you to ask questions during the call by typing them into the chat feature of the webinar. We'll answer any logistical or technology-related questions as they come in, and topical calls will be read aloud to the presenters during the Q&A portion of the webinar as time allows. Just a reminder, this webinar is being recorded. At this time, I'm happy to turn the call over to Hillary Meyer, Director of the National Resource Center on LGBT Aging. Hillary? Hillary, just a reminder, you'll need to press star 7 to unmute your line prior to your presentation.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, perfect.
Okay. Sorry, I was talking on mute.
I was
just saying that I was thanking the Long-Term Ombudsman Resource Center for hosting this topic, and I'm thrilled to be presenting to this audience. And I'm just so happy that these resource centers are teaming up in such an effective way. So my job here is to sort of give you the overview of the topic and talk a little bit about what the LGBT Aging Resource Center is doing, and provide some suggestions on some of the ways that we may be able to help you in your work. So I'm going to do that and then turn it over to our esteemed panel, and I'm excited to hear from a variety of different providers and from a service recipient herself. So with that, advance the next slide, please. All right, are we able to move? Oh, there we go. Okay. So as you can see on your screen, there are we sort of group the unique needs of LGBT older adults into three categories, and they're broad categories and not necessarily completely exhaustive. But essentially, we have a group of people who are dealing not only with the typical challenges of aging, but also have steeped on them various issues that come from both our country's history and the way that our current society functions. Firstly, the folks that are LGBT older adults themselves currently have lived through a number of years of pretty systemic discrimination, including both having homosexuality being pathologized through the early 70s, and also having a number of states continuing to call homosexuality a criminal activity, and that occurred really through the early 2000s. And as you might realize, this obviously has a tremendous effect on people's trust and fear for getting services from people that may be considered part of the establishments that were once so terribly discriminatory. Another issue that we see LGBT older adults face is that they rely on what we call families of choice more so than their straight peers. So they are more likely to be single, less likely to have children, and therefore they're relying more on their peer group to help them with the typical aging process, which can lead to, peers are growing older with them. And so with people having their own caregiving issues along with them, it can become a bit more of a burden than for some of the younger generations that people are used to relying on that aren't a member of the LGBT community. And finally, we still have a number of unequal laws and treatment across the country, including not being included in a number of relationship recognition schemes. Certainly marriage is the biggest one. The federal government still doesn't recognize marriage between same-sex couples, even for the states that do have the ability to have same-sex couples to get married. And that leads to a number of financial and other sort of healthcare access issues. Next slide. So this is a rather lengthy slide, and I'm just going to summarize it briefly. But the Administration on Aging finally realized and was able to publicly acknowledge that this is a community that does have unique needs and is deserving of some sort of funding. And they have a history of providing services and funding to groups with various specific needs. And so it was really a historic moment back in 2010 when AOA recognized that this indeed was a population that had its own needs. Next slide. Our vision statement is essentially that we're able to reach people wherever they are in whatever communities they live in and whatever networks they associate in and find a way for them to access culturally appropriate services and live in whatever settings they so choose. So that's our vision statement. Next slide. So the National Resource Center on LGBT Aging itself, abbreviated here as the NRC, is made up of 10 different partners. And you can see they're grouped into categories. We have training partners. We have our national groups that are reaching the aging networks. We have our LGBT portal partners. And finally, we have an evaluation partner who is looking at all of the what we do and trying to see if we're doing it as effectively as we want it to be doing. Next slide. What we're actually trying to accomplish is we're trying to reach the mainstream aging services, so the aging networks that you all work within. We're trying to reach LGBT organizations to sensitize them to the needs of the aging community. And we're trying to educate LGBT individuals themselves around preparing for their needs as they age. Next slide. So the three main ways that we try to accomplish this is we have a website, which as you can see the address is there underlined and bolded, which has a number of different resources available for all of the audiences that I just talked about. We have a technical assistance center, so you're able to email or call us, and we can try and help you. And that's available both for professionals and for LGBT people themselves. And finally, we're providing trainings across the country. And if you're interested in having your agency trained, you have to just request a training through our online through the website that's written on that slide. And right now, the trainings are being offered free of charge, so I recommend that if you're interested to please do go and request a training. Next slide. So this piece is going to be covered in depth by the other speakers, but I did want to touch on a little bit of the ways that the LGBT Aging Resource Center is trying to help affect community of the LGBT people living in long-term care facilities. It's difficult to measure how many people are in this situation. Many are closeted, and many are often just not being asked if they, you know, what their sexual orientation or gender identity is. So that obviously leads to some measurement problems. But there are some ways that we're trying to make some connections. One way I suggest is through the you folks yourselves. So if you know that there's an issue with somebody that that you're working with, you are always welcome to call us and try and get information, and we can try and help you in the best way that we can. So to getting connected through you all, people can connect to us directly. As I said, we're open to be hearing from older adults themselves. Certainly the website was designed with the idea that maybe people aren't comfortable making a phone call, but they might be willing to look at resources online. And finally, I just want to call out a particular sort of training model that has been of great effectiveness in St. Louis, Missouri. In St. Louis, SAGE, which is the organization that houses the Resource Center on LGBT Aging, SAGE has an affiliate in St. Louis. They're called SAGE Metro St. Louis. And an ombudsman in St. Louis from the St. Louis Long-Term Care Ombudsman Office, her name is Marilyn McCormick, made a connection with the SAGE office in St. Louis. And from that, they have actually been able to, Marilyn has been able to introduce SAGE and to go in and do trainings of staff in facilities in a number of different facilities. Almost on a weekly basis at this point, I think they're doing them. And it's really been an effective way to pair up actually what SAGE and some of the other resources that are available for LGBT older adults with the folks who are actually doing the work. And that's happening through the Ombudsman Office in that city. So, my time is up. So that's one way that we are finding that if an ombudsman can make a community partnership with somebody who's working in the LGBT aging field, it's a great way to introduce people into the facilities themselves. And so finally, the next slide, please. Some of the suggestions about ways that you can be open and inclusive or suggest with the folks that you're working with, the facilities themselves. Using inclusive language, so not asking if somebody's married, but asking if they have a partner or if they've had a partner. Using forms that reflect that same kind of inclusivity. Highlighting that confidentiality is really important, that if somebody is willing to disclose their sexual orientation or gender identity to you, that is going to not be gossiped about. It seems obvious, but a number of folks have a tremendous fear about that. And also advocating in a safe way. I use the word safe here because if a person is not comfortable sort of being the poster child for LGBT rights in a facility, what that might mean is really just trying to bring up the topic in a way that doesn't actually discuss that there may be a consumer there who actually this does matter to, but rather it's just a sort of general best practices way of functioning. And so you're going to hear a lot more in depth from the other speakers about that. So at that point, at this point, I'm going to turn it over to our next speaker, or I think I'm going to turn it back to Jessica, and I think there will be time for some questions at the end.
Great. Thank you so much, Hillary. And, yes, there will be time for question and answer at the end. Thanks for your presentation. At this time, I'd like to open the call up to Sue, who, as I mentioned, is a resident in a continuing care community in Colorado, and Sue's going to give us a consumer perspective on this topic. Sue? Just a reminder to our call speakers that to unmute your lines, you'll need to dial *7. Thank you. Sue, are you there? Okay, well, perhaps while we find Sue.
This is Jennifer. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay, now you can hear us. I don't know why it's not working on the speakerphone. Let me try again. Yeah, Sue's here with me. We just can't get this to do what we want it to do.
Thanks, Jennifer.
So, can you hear us now?
Yes, we can.
Okay, go ahead, Sue. There you go.
Yep, that's what it was. Okay.
My name is Sue, and I'm a 73-year-old lesbian, and I've just changed my mind on what I'm going to say. I need to preface this, however, by saying that I have just read a few books that have been helpful to me and ask for your patience. The first one is Tears Legitimize Words. And I would apologize for crying, but I won't anymore because it means I feel very deeply about it. The second thing is compassion. I always thought I was compassionate and that other people weren't in my justifiable ideas. I thought everybody was prejudiced against me and who I knew, and recently I have found that by showing and telling my story without, when I withheld my story, I did not allow them to show their compassion. So that's why I'm speaking today, is because I think it gave you a chance to show your compassion. I'll get over it in a minute. I think that the speaker before covered all the areas in terms of the notes that I had made, and they all stem from social, and they mainly are legal and medical in essence as far as I was concerned. I am in a dual world. I have always lived as a closet lesbian. I'm a professional person. I have always kept that as a secret. I felt that I would be fired if it were known. I worked in pediatrics, and nobody would like to have their little girls taken care of by me, I felt. And so I lived apart from that. So that, and that comes up is that it means I'm not accepted for who I am, and that means then I become paranoid and think everybody is against me, and therefore I cannot be honest. So it compromises myself as a human being. Just a couple of examples, I think, that you've covered them, and you probably know them better than I do in terms of legality and what we came up with. We both had separate holdings. We had separate bank accounts, and then a mutual one, and that worked very well. And also, it worked very well until my partner developed Alzheimer's. And then it became very confused as to, was I really capable of managing her money? And questions came up, legality came up, we had to seek a lawyer, we had to clarify, power of attorney, power of medical attorney, power of legal attorney. It got very confused as to what happened. That melded over into, because she is 86 and has many medical conditions, it came up to, do I have the right to speak for her? She had a medical condition, a lipoma taken off of her neck, and I was took her to the doctor, and he came out and said, oh, things are fine, no problem, and walked out, and I assumed his assistant was doing the sutures, and I didn't say a thing, and I waited, and I waited, and I waited. And after a half hour or so, I thought, well, this is ridiculous. So I walked up to the lady, and she said, oh, my. We didn't know she had a ride. She's in the emergency room across the way. She had a arterial fibrillation. and nobody knew who I was. I told her I was their partner, and I was there for her. And then they said, well, do you have the paper of power of attorney? And I said, well, I left it at the place where she had surgery. And they said, well, that won't do for her. You'll have to have it done. You'll have to go back and get it, or you'll have to do something. You can't give any information or speak for her in any way. And then there was a time when she has macular degeneration. She's getting shots in her eyes. And of course, it was done on a Friday. And Saturday, it turned red and was bleeding. And I was really concerned, so I called the doctor. And of course, it was the doctor on the call, not my doctor. And he said, now, who are you? And I said, I'm her partner. He says, what does that mean? I said, that means that I've been living with her for 50 years and I have power of attorney and I can talk for her. And he said, well, I can't do anything about it anyway. Call your other physician. So anyway, those are just a couple of examples that I have that were showing why that reinforces the difficulty that we have in getting and relating to people. I think that another thing, though, that I would like to say before I close would be that, as I mentioned, we chose to go to, I chose, because Tony couldn't make the decisions at that time, to go to an assisted living. And in May, I had to put her in the memory clinic for Alzheimer's. Prior to that time, because it was assisted living, the types of responses that I got from people who lived in the community, and it's a Christian community, some were pleasant. Nobody invited us to dinner. Nobody asked us to join anything. And it was either a nod, how are things, how are you doing, or ignoring us, or out-and-out hostility. So we pretty much kept our room. When my partner went into Alzheimer's, however, there was a switch. And that's when I found out about compassion. But several of the people there either had partner, husbands, wives, or knew about that. And so what they said was, they began to understand from a human point of view, from a compassion point of view, what I was going through with Alzheimer's. So that was a lesson to me that that is possible. Yeah. So any questions I'd like to ask?
Thank you, Sue, so much for your presentation. We really appreciate your honesty and your candidness on this event. As I mentioned, we will be opening up for questions a little bit later in the call, so if you don't mind waiting until then, and I'm sure people will have questions and comments for you at that point. At this time, I'd like to introduce Eric Carlson, who, as I mentioned, is the directing attorney with the National Senior Citizens Law Center. Eric?
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be on the call today. Could you move to the next slide, please? And just a very quick mention, National Senior Citizens Law Center does litigation and education and policy advocacy in a variety of legal issues that pertain to older Americans, particularly older folks without much money who are in particularly vulnerable situations. And I, as attorneys of our office, have a particular focus on long-term care issues, nursing facilities, assisted living facilities, and increasingly home and community-based services. Next slide, please. And then the slide after that, please. Our recent work in our office around LGBT issues is based on a survey that we did with other partners, the Task Force and SAGE and Center for Lesbian Rights and some other folks. And the survey was offered online. Hillary had mentioned earlier the difficulty of the absence of data, and this was meant to address that to a certain extent, although with a caveat, certainly. This is not the kind of survey that's generate statistically significant results because it was on the internet and open to anyone who chose to answer. So it's not something that we submit to a scientific journal, but which I think doesn't really diminish the message that we get from the results, because I think some of the percentages were stark, and also in particular some of the individual situations that were presented by people who answered the survey demonstrated a lot of very important issues. And in the time I have today, I'll touch on a few of those, the good exemplars of some of the troubles that folks have to work through within long-term care facilities. Next slide, please. And here's the address for the web address for the report. You see it there. The report's available on this website. And also, there's a chat function on the bottom of the page, which has some interesting back and forth from people about their own impressions. And also, our office went out after the report was put together and did some video with some of the people who had responded to the survey and who had offered their stories. And the video interviews offer some nice insights as to what people need to work through. Next slide, please. And everybody here on the call does a lot of work with long-term care facilities, and I think we all know the difficulty of any person, regardless of sexual orientation or gender identity, of dealing with moving into a nursing facility, assisted living facility, or other facility. It's a very disorienting experience. People feel intimidated by the staff. They're separated from family. They're tossed in with a lot of strangers. All of us who do this work know the really complicated emotional and logistical issues that are presented by a move to a long-term care facility. But then you see when LGBT folks are presented with some of these same issues, you've got those similar problems, but multiplied in difficulty, 10 times, 100 times, however you want to think of it. A lot of the same issues that any long-term care resident struggles through become a little bit more perplexing for the LGBT population. So from the survey that we did, here are some particular areas of concern that were identified by the survey respondents. The fear of being out. All of a sudden you're put in a group living environment, surrounded by people who may not approve of you to a certain extent, or possibly, you just don't know one way or another. Hillary spoke to a lot of the personal history of LGBT folks over the last decades, and these discriminatory issues are things that folks have confronted throughout their lives, and for those folks who've been essentially closeted, this is a particularly difficult situation. And even our survey respondents reported for people who had been out of the closet in their lives, sometimes felt obligated to walk back into the closet when forced to live in a group living situation like a nursing facility or assisted living facility. Some of the other concerns: harassment by the residents or staff, the refusal of the facility to honor decision-making authority. Sue mentioned this a bit in her presentation, refusal to use a preferred name or pronoun, and just poor care, but poor care in a way that seems motivated to a certain extent by discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. Next slide, please. This is a little more information on the in-the-closet, out-of-the-closet issue. Of the survey respondents, only 22% of the LGBT respondents could say that they could be open with long-term care facility staff. And that's just a very troubling result. Again, speaking to folks on the phone who know long-term care, quality of life is such an important issue. All the culture change talk about the whole idea of resident-centered care involves addressing people as themselves, not as some sort of generic care recipient, but as human beings with real with preferences and ways that they want to live and to be treated. And for LGBT folks, their inability even to be honest about it, to present their true selves to the people around them is just a very troubling, stifling, oppressive type of situation. And I think the results are very sobering in this regard. Next slide, please. This is one example from the survey, and we did a little bit of follow up on this. The couple that had been together forever, almost 60 years, and when the one woman moved to the assisted living facility, they felt that they couldn't be honest. And the partner, rather than walking in and saying, "Yes, I'm her partner," passed herself off as a sister instead. And then later, after the first woman had passed on, the second woman, Zeta, found herself in a long-term care facility and confronted more issues about more inability to be out and as to her sexual orientation, wary about putting up any photos of herself with her partner, afraid to tell the truth, and just having that whole part of her hidden. Obviously, in long-term care facilities, the pictures of the family and the grandchildren is a big part of the room, a big part of the conversation. But Zeta, in this situation, just didn't have any of that. She felt she couldn't be open about that and was forced to keep that part of herself hidden from those around her. Next slide, please. So what does the Ombudsman do about that? Some of this has been raised earlier by Hillary. Here's some suggestions. You're obviously speaking to the residents. Maybe there's an opportunity for the Ombudsman to be a little bit of a liaison. You can imagine the nursing facilities taking steps. There are some programs out there to encourage cultural confidence in these LGBT issues, and this is a step that the facility might want to take, both because it's likely good business and also because it's arguably part of the accommodation of individual needs obligation of the nursing home reform law. Next slide, please. Discrimination service provision. This was submitted by on this survey from a story relating to John and Jack. The Jack, the long-term care resident, didn't have a shower for several weeks because the staff in the facility who was assigned evidently felt uncomfortable in providing care to him, which, of course, is completely wrong. And John reported online that in their current facility, they didn't even try to get showers in the facility. Instead, John brought Jack home in order to give him a shower. Next slide, please. So the Ombudsman response here, there's clearly a violation here. That's not an adequate quality of care, regardless of motivation, and particularly if the motivation is based on the individual sexual orientation. And this is also something that could be addressed with a cultural competency training. The staff has to get the message, and they need to get the message. There's a couple ways of delivering it. One is you got to do your job, and the second is could be more of a kind of consciousness raising side to it. Next slide, please. These decision-making issues are common legal problems for LGBT folks and their partners. Sue mentioned a bit of this in her own difficulties in being able to make, to be recognized as the authorized decision maker for her partner. In the scenario presented in our survey, the couple, the partners evidently did not have the legal documentation that they were meant to be decision makers for each other. And when the one partner lost capacity, the biological family came in and really cut out the partner, which is obviously a tremendously sad situation. Next slide, please.
No, we got, we sold everything.
Somebody needs to mute their phone because we're getting some feedback here. Thank you. Just a quick mention there. President Obama and the federal government have taken some steps towards dealing with visiting rights. There are a presidential memo in 2010 saying that hospitals should recognize choices by patients as to who should be allowed to visit. Next slide, please. And then that's actually been incorporated in the federal regulation now. And there you see the citations there. Next slide, please. The ombudsman response to this, there are a couple of alternatives. First is that the people need to execute documents. The best, there's obviously a huge advantage for those folks who have documented their preferences ahead of time. You want, regardless of what the laws in the underlying states, folks should sign the necessary decision-making documents, including but not limited to powers of attorney, to make sure that there's the best legal backup possible. And and secondly, there's some movement, if we're not here yet, to in informal guidance to recognize that LGB partners should be recognized as decision makers, even in the absence of formal legal authority. In the Nursing Facility Surveyor's Guidelines, there's a fair number of references to family. A family should be noticed, and family should have some decision-making rights. And, it's possible at some foreseeable time down the road that may be, the Surveyor's Guidelines may be modified to reflect the proper role that LGB partners should have in these situations, and we'll have to keep our eyes open for changes like that. Next slide, please. Just briefly where we're heading. As I mentioned, CMS is going down this road a bit. I think AOA's funding of Hillary's organization and what SAGE is coordinating is a tremendous step forward. I list a citation here for relevant California law that mandates training for healthcare providers on better providing care to LGBT patients and residents, which is another positive legal step forward. Next slide, please. There's also the argument, and I think that people are on the right side of history on this one, is that it just is increasingly making business sense for long-term care facilities, like other businesses, to be open and affirming to an LGBT population. And ombudsmen talking with facilities are going to want to cite the legal arguments, but also should be making the case, as is true for any kind of resident-centered care, that good care is good business, and it's a way for facilities to distinguish themselves and to attract to make themselves available to a broader population and to be attractive to people in general. So next slide, please, which is the conclusion, and I'll turn it back to the moderator for our next speaker.
Thanks, Eric. Our next speaker is Jennifer Solms, who's an ombudsman with the Denver Regional Council of Governments in Colorado. Jennifer?
This is Jennifer. I think I'm unmuted here.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, next slide, please. Again, my name is Jennifer Solms. I am an ombudsman with the Denver Regional Council of Governments here in Denver, Colorado. I am truly pleased and honored to be chosen to be a part of this panel to talk about some of the work we're doing here in the Colorado, in the state of Colorado, and specifically in the Denver and Boulder metro areas to try and make things better for our LGBT elders out here. Next slide, please. So we use a training tool called Project Visibility. Project Visibility is a cultural competency training program that was developed by Boulder County Aging Services here in Colorado. The purpose of this is to educate providers and sensitize them to the needs and the issues facing our LGBT elders. What we use in order to present this information is we are lucky enough that there were elders in the metro area as well as in Boulder who were willing to go on camera and talk about what it was like for them to grow up LGBT, to live their life LGBT, and what their fears or concerns are as they age and consider the idea of needing services, whether it's in home or going into a long-term care community. In addition, we also use a PowerPoint presentation and then obviously spend a lot of time on steps that different nursing homes, assisted livings, and other service providers can take in order to be more sensitive to this population and to be welcoming and friendly. Next slide, please. So why is there a training on LGBT elders? And obviously it was touched on by our other presenters. There's an increasing evidence that LGBT elders in our community don't know where they're going to go if they need care support services. Many of them cannot identify who would care for them if they became ill. Also, there is the concern with the level of sensitivity and awareness on the part of staff at facilities, at businesses they interact with, as well as other service agencies. We have a statistic from the Williams Institute at UCLA that estimates 4.1% of Americans right now identify as gay, lesbian, or bi. And that means that we have approximately 1.5 million folks over the age of 65 who are part of this community. By 2030, estimates are closer to 3 million. Unfortunately, we don't have much as far as numbers on the transgender community. Next slide, please. As Hillary touched on, and we always touch on in our presentation as well, and we have Elver in the photo who was a part of the video and spoke on camera for the Project Visibility DVD. But there are the effects of stigma, past and present, that LGBT elders had to live with, and their heterosexual counterparts did not, and their cisgender counterparts did not. They have reliance on families of choice who lack any kind of legal or social recognition, as has been touched on by every presenter before me, of what the challenges of that are and how it makes it that much harder. Additionally, they have unequal treatment under laws and programs for older adults. Specifically, I know in the state of Colorado, we do have spousal protection for the community spouse and a married couple. If somebody goes into a nursing home, the spouse is protected in some way so that they're not impoverished or lose their home and end up homeless. Unfortunately, in Colorado, we have no recognition of same-sex relationships, and so in a situation where you have partners, whether they've been together 10 years or 50 years, both spouses can lose everything, and the person in the community may end up impoverished simply because their partner's going into a nursing home. Next slide, please. The concerns, we are seeing increased isolation. 75% live alone. 90% do not have children as compared to their heterosexual counterparts, where it's only 35% of people live alone and 20% don't have children. That could leave them at risk for increased depression. They end up in nursing homes and other types of settings prematurely. We see issues with self-neglect. Or neglect by caregivers because they are more likely to need the formal caregiving systems that are available but less likely to access them due to the fears, again, that have been touched on and has been a theme of the entire presentation. And the issue that we're dealing with is obviously they're invisible to service providers. And what we're seeing as well and working very hard is that they're also invisible to the GLBT community as a whole, and that's a product of ageism in general, which can be more pronounced in the GLBT community. Next slide, please. It's We also see strength, though, in our LGBT elders. You know, as we go through all the challenges that they have to face, we also like to touch on what the strengths of this community is. They share a common culture, and this goes beyond just identifying as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. There's a shared history there, language. There's things that they connect them as a culture that maybe you don't see in the heterosexual community. They share coming out stories and what it was like to have to do that, you know, not just once, not just twice, but throughout their lives. This is a group that is pretty self-reliant and is pretty good at creating their own support network. Many of them were isolated from their biological families when they did come out, and so they had to develop these families of choice. And also they have developed coping skills in dealing with a hostile environment. We see that many of them actually are better able to handle the ageism versus their straight counterparts because they've had to live in environments where people were hostile towards them, you know, their whole lives, that's been a part of their reality at times for some folks. Next slide, please. So what does providing competent services involve? You know, I think this sentence sums it up the best. It's the ability to listen, respond, and provide polite and considerate care to all residents, regardless of personal feelings, beliefs, or values about their character or behaviors. That is the basis of all of this. Obviously, we're going to spend more time talking about what can we specifically do. Next slide, please. So these are the slides that I actually use when I'm training assisted living and nursing home providers, as well as other service agencies, but I think it holds true for the ombudsman as well. We need to explicitly welcome LGBT people to the place of service. Again, for nursing homes and assisted livings, it's being open. And when I say explicitly welcome, it's looking at brochures you hand out. I know as ombudsman, we hand out brochures about our program, but looking at are there pictures of same-sex couples if you include pictures in your brochures? Do you explicitly say in any of your materials or in a mission statement that you do not discriminate based on sexual orientation or gender identity? And also encourage your homes to get training. Look at intake forms. My favorite is the relationship status. You get to check a box: single, widowed, married, or divorced. Unfortunately, there's no room in those checkboxes for LGBT couples to tell their story or explain their relationship. So we recommend that they put relationship status and a line and let folks fill that in so that they can identify anybody that is important to them with their own language, name that person, all that good stuff. It's important to use appropriate terms. We spend a lot of time in our training just training providers on what the appropriate terms are: gay, lesbian, bisexual. It's also important to ask transgender people what term, name, and pronouns that they prefer and use these in all situations. It's not okay to have a trans person who may be biologically male, definitely presents as female, and start using male pronouns, especially if they introduce themselves to you as a female and have a female name. It's obvious that they would want female pronouns used. If you don't know, again, we encourage you to ask. And refrain from speculating about a person's sexual orientation or gender identity. When we meet folks in homes, just because they were never married does not necessarily mean they are a part of this community. We should not make any assumptions about any of our residents. Next slide, please. Assume in any home you walk into and in any group of folks you interact with, whether it's in your professional life or personal life, that LGBT people are present. If your sexual orientation is heterosexual, understand your privilege and the ways it's rewarded in this culture. Sue touched on some of the challenges that she's had to deal with, that if she was able to legally marry her partner, she would not have those challenges. That is a privilege that the heterosexual community has at this point in time. You know, whether or not that changes, we have to look to the future. But at this time, it is a privilege that the heterosexual community has, and it is rewarded in today's society. And we encourage folks that they learn about the LGBT community and culture that exists around them. If there is a GLBT community center in your area, please touch base with them, find out what programs and resources they have for their elders. Have any, find a way that you can partner and maybe start developing these connections, these relationships in order to make homes more friendly to this community. Again, find out where your nearest Pride celebration is if you can't find a community center that is specific for the GLBT community, and find out who organizes that and start touching base with those folks. You can also try to find PFLAG chapters in your area. That stands for Parents, Friends, and Family of Lesbians and Gays. It is a organization that is made up of not only LGBT folks, but their allies, their family, and their loved ones. But touch base with those agencies. You can look up PFLAG online and find a local chapter that's nearby you and find a way to partner with that organization. And as Hillary mentioned, there are SAGE affiliates around the country. And so find out if there is a SAGE affiliate in your area. I know in some areas that may not be in existence, but if there is one nearby, or if there's one you can even contact in your region via phone to get information, that would be great. That's a wonderful way to do it. Find ways to make LGBT culture visible in your organization. Again, as ombudsman, I think we need to explicitly put in our materials that we are welcoming to this community and that we will serve them, and we do not discriminate based on any of this. We should be encouraging homes, you know, during the month of June to celebrate Pride Month, to find out what's going on, to have films, to have books, to have all that information in their libraries. If they have a library in some places, they have that type of stuff. But they need to have ways that they show that they are friendly to this community. And obviously, any home and any ombudsman should be able to make appropriate referrals to services, resources, organizations that can help somebody who is an LGBT elder. I think we have more responsibility to do that as ombudsmen, but it's also our job to educate our homes on what those resources are so that they're able to make those referrals. Next slide, please. And communicating effectively. You know, we can't be offended or distracted if people accuse us of being gay or lesbian for simply taking a stand for this community. It is important that we interrupt any type of anti-LGBT comments, jokes, stereotypic pronouncements, just anything that we observe or hear by our peers, by our colleagues, by residents themselves, by the staff in the homes that we visit and we investigate concerns. I mean, we really need to be very cognizant of that and putting an end to it when we do hear it and see it. Also, if a resident is out to us, we cannot assume that they are out to everyone, and so it's important that we maintain that confidentiality. And even if the other person that you're speaking with is also part of the LGBT community, again, it's not okay to out somebody without their permission. And we also must respect the person's decision on whether or not to come out or to not do that. And again, I can't say it enough that it's important for us to just listen without judgment and protect their rights. As ombudsmen, I think we frequently meet residents who we don't agree with everything that they do, the choices that they make. You know, we may have different belief systems than the residents we advocate for, but just like with any other type of diverse group that we work with, we must be sensitive and we must be aware of what the challenges are for our LGBT elders in our nursing homes and assisted livings. And we must represent them with the same vigor and passion we do every other resident we work with. Next slide, please. We always wrap up our presentation with this. They always say time changes things, but you actually have to change them yourself. And I think as ombudsmen, we know that. As advocates, that's what we do. And the last slide, please. For those who want information on the project visibility trainings that are done here in Colorado, there are three ways. I typically do this presentation when we do the three-hour version with Sherry Wilkins, who works at the GLBT Community Center of Colorado here in Denver. They are a SAGE affiliate here. They are the SAGE of the Rockies, and it has her information, her email address, her phone number, and the website for their organization. Also, you have my information. I am happy to talk to any ombudsman across the country who wants some feedback or information on how to better serve LGBT elders and how we can educate the assisted livings and nursing homes we're going into. And the very last website is the Project Visibility website itself. That is a website where you can go to find information on obtaining the training materials that they have made available for folks to do these trainings anywhere in the nation. And that website will have all the information as far as contacts at Boulder County Aging Services, of their specialists there who do this as their job, as well as, again, a list of resources, a way to order the DVD, a way to order their training manuals. All that stuff will be found on that website. And that concludes my portion of our presentation today. Thank you.
Thanks, Jennifer, and thanks to all our speakers. At this time, I'd like to open the webinar up for questions from participants. We have received a few questions already throughout the call, which I'll pose now. But just a reminder, if you have a question or if you think of something over the next few minutes that you'd like to ask the presenters, you can type your question into the online chat feature of the webinar, and I'll read it aloud to our presenters. And to our speakers, please feel free to keep your lines unmuted throughout this portion so you can respond to anything that you wish. A reminder, it's *7 to unmute your lines for speakers. So the first question that came in related to the website, for the National Resource Center on LGBT Aging. It looked as though there might have been a typo in the website posted in the PowerPoint, so I just wanted to clarify that the correct website for that organization is LGBTAging, with a G at the end, center.org. And when we post the materials online, we'll make sure that that is updated. Another question that came from Patty Ducaye in Texas, and she wrote, "My interpretation of recent changes to the SOM Appendix PP guidance to surveyors seems like an opening for unmarried couples to room together. Though that is not the same as giving equal treatment, the revised language about couples sharing a room seemed like a real step forward." So not exactly a question, but I thought I'd put that out there for the speakers and see if anyone wanted to comment on that or respond.
This is Eric. I'd agree. Anything that gives people choice is, in general, positive. It doesn't have to be specifically identified as a choice for one population or another. But I agree with Patty.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another question came in from Maryland this time. Eileen Bennett asks why there are not as many stats available for transgendered folks. She's wondering if that has to do with collection methods or maybe it's just that it's a newer label.
This is Jennifer, and I mean, the others can chime in as well. Is frankly, nobody's bothered to count them. Nobody's bothered to ask. You know, when you look at the census, for example, your only choices are to check the boxes is male or female. And so, I don't know if there's anything specific as far as trying to get a better idea of how many folks are out there. But to be honest, a lot of people until recently have not agencies, groups that take this type of information, government that collects data, has not asked.
Yeah, and this is Hillary. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I would just add to that the LGBT Aging Resource Center partners is Forge Transgender Aging Network, and they have they're sort of the premier group that's working on transgender aging issues on a national level, and I would urge you to check out the resources that they have available, and they have some statistics, too, that are helpful. Their website is forgeforward.org, forgeforward.org.
Great, thank you. The next thing that came in was actually a comment, not exactly a question, but I'll share it with everyone. It's from a participant who read in her local newspaper in California that there were plans to build a combination retirement home / assisted living home for LGBT residents. And so she indicated she read that several months ago and isn't sure how it's progressing, but I think that's worth sharing. Interesting. Another question that came in has to do with whether or not Florida has an LGBT organization, and I'm wondering if any of our speakers know about that or might be able to direct somebody on how to find out if that's the case.
This is Hillary. There are a number of organizations. Was there a specific question about which type of LGBT organization?
No, they just asked generally if there's an LGBT organization in the state.
Okay. The one that I'm most familiar with is the group Centerlink, who also is a partner on our resource center. They're the umbrella group to all the LGBT community centers across the country. And as a partner on the National Resource Center on LGBT Aging, they also are well-versed in both local dynamics around LGBT aging as well as what's going on across the country in LGBT community centers. So you can check them out. And I believe their let me just check their website. Yeah, their website is lgbtcenters.org.
And it looks as though they were specifically looking for information about a support group in Florida that just came in.
Oh, a support group. That I don't have information off of the top of my head, but I can try and help. If that person wants to connect with me directly, I can try and navigate with them offline.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Another question is whether or not the Denver Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program includes the Project Visibility Training or a similar training for their volunteer ombudsman during the certification process.
Interesting enough, the Denver Regional Council of Governments for 22 years did have a volunteer ombudsman program. Unfortunately, due to an increased number of requirements to our program, compliance with documentation and other types of things, we have actually eliminated our volunteer program. But what I can say is prior to doing that, we did regularly train our volunteers with the Project Visibility training. We did put aspects of that into our basic training that we did with volunteers, as well as we would do monthly trainings for our volunteers in which I did present to them. The most recently was July. As I said, though, we've unfortunately been in a position where we've had to eliminate our volunteer ombudsman program as of October 1st. So we work with staff. We work and do what we do with staff only at this time, and all of our staff have been trained through Project Visibility.
Thank you. And back to the Florida question, one of our participants commented that they're aware of an organization called Equality Florida, which and also NLRC in Tampa, which looks as though it stands for National Lesbian Resource Center. We have a request for you, Hillary, as to whether you can address if your website has a list of state centers or resources.
Yes, we I should say that our website is constantly in production. So we do have a list of local resources, at least on the state levels. The way that you find it is if you go to the Resource Center website, which thank you for correcting my typo, lgbtagingcenter.org, and then click on in the top middle of the screen you see resources, and then you get another screen right below it. It says resources in your area. And what you then are brought to is a national map where you can click on any individual state and take a look at the resources that we are trying to accumulate. And again, because it is a work in progress, I'm really hoping to hear from folks on the ground who know of resources that we may not know about that we can just add into those listed resources. So please do contact me if we're missing things. I'm positive that we are. I'm just hoping that we get the information from folks who are doing the good work like you all are.
Thank you. And I just also wanted to share that we're getting a lot of comments thanking Sue specifically for sharing her personal story. So thanks again, Sue. We still have several minutes left for questions, so what I'll do at this time is open up the call lines. and let you all try to ask questions. Just a reminder, if you do hear someone else asking a question, if maybe you can defer to them, we're unable to open individual lines, so just a warning about that.
Don't talk at the same time.
Yes.
The conference has been unmuted.
Okay, so all lines should be unmuted. So if anyone has a question, please feel free to ask.
I received the email saying that I was going to reach out to the Sweet Care group. I'm looking for that, and I can't find it.
So this is Robin Grant with the Consumer Voice, and I have a question for Eric. Just wondering how much mileage advocates can get in the nursing home setting under the nursing home reform law with the residents' rights to visit with whomever they want.
You know, we don't have it. He had it. I didn't think that I sent it.
Yeah, I think that that's, it can get a long way. That the it addresses timing of visits. So the reform law and the surveyor's guidelines are really good about access. And the surveyor's guidelines are good as well about talking about the visitor of the resident's choice. It's clear that if you talk about right to visit, it's the right of the resident to receive a visitor as opposed to the right of a visitor to visit. So I think people are in good shape. As always, the only tricky thing is when the competence of the resident is in some question, and then it's more of a free-for-all. And then you get these situations where the biological family lines up against, I mean, worst case scenario, right? Biological family lines up against the partner, and the facility may or may not take sides, and that's when it gets trickier.
And this is Jennifer. I want to kind of jump in because I actually did recently, one of our ombudsmen did run into something along these lines of what you just talked about. And in assisted living, that is a secure memory care home for folks with Alzheimer's and dementia, and there is a gentleman in there who is pretty cognitively impaired and had a power of attorney who was a friend. He had spent his life being a leader of a church. I can't remember exactly his title, if it was a pastor or the word is escaping me right now. I'm not as familiar, but spent most of his life living that way, and there was a gentleman who would visit regularly, and then it became apparent that they were fairly affectionate, and so the home, instead of just, you know, kind of watching to make sure that that was a wanted contact, went ahead and called the power of attorney, whose response was, well, you know, he was a pastor his whole life, he's not going to be gay now. So, you know, it was really kind of inappropriate, and that was an opportunity that, you know, we had to not only talk to the administrator about the inappropriateness of that, in the sense of certainly we want to be aware that folks with impairments, we want to be ensure that any type of affection is consensual, but you can find that out by watching people. And the person who's going to fight you to take a shower is certainly going to fight somebody who's hugging them. And this gentleman clearly enjoyed the visit from his male visitor. We don't know the nature of the relationship. We've not asked. But, you know, we really did educate the staff on that. The more appropriate thing at that time was to monitor and make sure that it was consensual, that that was their responsibility. And the POA's opinion of whether or not this gentleman was gay was irrelevant at that point in time. And so they actually did get to a place where they did educate the power of attorney and just said he has the right to the visitor, and as long as he is expressing to us that these visits are wanted, he's smiling, he's happy to see this man, he's showing affection, that they would continue unless they saw any kind of anything from the resident to show otherwise.
Just a quick reminder to folks who are not asking questions, if you could mute your lines either through your personal phone by pressing the mute button or by dialing *6, that will help prevent some of the background noise that's coming through. We have received another question online.
Okay.
As a manager of volunteers, I've stressed expectations about not discriminating, but as a last resort, I've said that if a volunteer ombudsman cannot separate their personal beliefs and help an individual, they must refer the question or case to a staff ombudsman. The question is, if the speakers think that's ample to really serve all residents, or if it would be better to set an expectation of no excuses.
This is Jennifer, and when we had our volunteers, that's exactly how we handled it. We made it very clear that it is our expectation that they separate themselves and that, you know, they advocate for everybody regardless of their personal feelings on anything about that person. But as I'm sure you have recognized and the way you're handling it, it's harder to demand that of a volunteer because they're volunteering to do this. They're not a staff. And so I think at times you are dealing with a slightly different level of professionalism to some degree. And so, yeah, that is how we have historically throughout our program have handled it. It is our expectation that you do this, but if you find yourself in a position where you are unable, it is mandatory that you refer that case to one of the staff ombudsmen so that they can provide that service and advocacy to that resident.
Any other questions, either over the phone or through the web? Probably have time for about one more question.
I have a question.
Sure, go ahead, please.
Okay. I just wondered if any of the presenters will be at the Consumer Voice annual meeting talking about project visibility or any of the other issues that they presented today.
This is Jennifer, and I am not scheduled to be at that conference. I believe somebody from COG will, or the Denver Regional Council of Governments, excuse me, will be there, but no, I am not going to that specific conference to present.
Yeah, this is Hillary. I actually had a conflicting symposium, unfortunately, so not this year, but.
So this is Eric. There is an LGBT themed session at the Consumer Voice conference. And I know I'm part of that along with some other folks.
Yes, okay, thank you, Eric. And along with Eric will also be Robert Espinoza from SAGE participating in that session.
Great.
Good. And is project visibility, is that something that other state ombudsman programs can use?
Absolutely. Again, I encourage you to go to the website. This was a training developed by Boulder County Aging Services, and so the ability to get those training materials is solely managed by Boulder County Aging Services.
Okay.
You know, certainly it's they have gone to national conferences, including N4A and some others, throughout the years, to train folks on how to do this. But definitely go to their website because you are able to order the materials online.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, well, I'd like to be respectful of everyone's time, and so I am going to wrap this up. Thank you to all of our speakers for the excellent and informative presentations, and to all of the participants who joined us today and for raising some really interesting questions. We hope this webinar has been useful. As a reminder, the webinar recording, along with the materials, including speaker PowerPoints, et cetera, will be available on the National Ombudsman Resource Center website following the call. At www.ltcombudsman.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.
Thank you. Please stand by.